right. Here we go. Well, thank you very much for having me here. It's a delight to be back in Melbourne and a delight to be back at Ridley. I was here in the 80s. It's a long time ago. As we start, I would like to again acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional custodians of this part of God's land and pay my respects to their elders past, present and the emerging leaders for the future. And also to pay my respects to any First Peoples who might be present here with us today. I need to acknowledge that I'm speaking from my context as a white, dominant culture, middle class, getting old woman. And I'm not seeking to represent the views of Aboriginal people, but rather the views of what I have actually learned from Aboriginal people through my time at Noongalinya College. Well, our theme is being grounded. It's actually a very interesting term, isn't it? It's kind of an unusual term for a conference to do with academia. The words grounded, academia, they don't seem to go together to me. So I was thinking, what does this word grounded mean? And I was looking at it from a few different perspectives. So, you know, if I was an electrician, it's connecting it to the ground so you're not going to get electrocuted. I got that one. When we think about it, the use of the word in contemporary culture, it's really referring to being authentic, isn't it? Being real. That's what they mean by being grounded. From a theological perspective, we might say it's being connected to the ground of our being, God, Father, Son and Holy Spirit. And if it was a teenager, it might be not going out for a month. There are many ways of interpreting it. I think it's very interesting coming up to this talk that the word was... Is my thing sinking? It is. Yes. I'll just put it back up again. There we go. It's going for the ground. How's that? It's interesting that the theme for Reconciliation Week this year, does anybody know what it was? What's on the board? There we go. Was grounded in truth, walk together with courage. And it carries this idea that you have to face the and connect with the past if there's going to be any possibility. It's sinking again. Any possibility of walking into the future. Okay. There we go. I'm really tall. Okay. But I'm really close. Okay.
I don't know if we're winning or not, but we'll try.
We'll try. If it gets terrible, I'll just hold it. Okay. Okay. So, as I said, it carries with us this idea you must face the truth of the past if you're going to walk together into the future, and I think that's an essential message for us as Australian Christians. But I think it's also a good way for us to think about what it is for women in academia to be grounded. Often the world of academia seems to be primarily related to ideas rather than ministry or life. And that's one of the accusations that people make about theological colleges, that they're ivory towers, out of touch with reality. A lot of people say, I wouldn't go there because I'd lose my faith. I've heard that many times. The accusation is that academic work is not grounded and there's a real danger of losing your way. And for me personally, this has actually been quite a source of frustration, both as a student and as a lecturer, that there appears to be an expectation of a disconnection between this world of ideas and really getting into the Bible and our ministry and life experience. I think that was a significant factor in my choice of a topic for a doctoral thesis. So my thesis was about how to study theology for personal transformation. How can our learning actually build up our relationship with God, with the world, and with each other? And I think as women in academia, we actually have a wonderful opportunity to present a different way of doing theology. When our theology is grounded, it has the ability to be transformational both for individuals and for our church and society. As was said in the introduction, I spent the last 8 years as the principal of Noongalinya College in Darwin. And going to Noongalinya was certainly a very big change for me from working in a theological college in Melbourne. Firstly, all the students were from different cultures, Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders, mostly Aboriginal. Secondly, we were actually operating in the vocational education sector rather than the higher education sector. So students studied from Certificate 1 through to Certificate 4, and Certificate 3 and 4 were certificates in Christian ministry and theology. Doing theology in the vet sector is just really different to the higher ed sector because you are required to teach skills and make the connection from what you're learning to how you're going to do it in your vocation. So that was actually a really good thing. The last thing, though, was that I was confronted by the huge inequities present in our society and the generational trauma that is experienced by Aboriginal people in an ongoing and painful reality. It was a very rich and challenging time, and I was learning many things about what it is to be a Christian in this country. I use the term was learning because I wouldn't say I've actually mastered any of it, and you're hearing a little bit of the journey that I'm on. Aboriginal people have a very different way of learning to that in a traditional theological college, which has we sort of have research, lectures, critical thinking, debate. The Western model, when you think about it, is actually very adversarial. You have to defend your ideas against attack. You have to demonstrate the validity of those ideas based on a particular rationalistic model of logic and particular expectations about models of biblical exegesis. And the topics and outcomes of those things might vary from college to college, but the methodology is pretty much the same in the West. I don't know if it's the same in England, but that's what it's like here in my experience. In reality, I would question whether this methodology is actually helpful for emerging generations of people, particularly with the influence of technology and changes in culture as they exist. Well, Aboriginal people learn in a very different way. One of the biggest complaints I would hear about teaching at Noongalinya was the students would go, "Too fast, too fast, slow down." Knowledge is accumulated very slowly over many, many years in small increments, and you didn't get the next piece of knowledge until you had mastered the one before. We haven't really caught on with that idea, I don't think. And knowledge was something which was entrusted to people. This is very different to our idea that knowledge is something free that anyone can access, usually through the internet, and doesn't require you to have the underpinning understandings to understand that knowledge. And learning is always done in a communal context. Tyson Yunker Porter, an Aboriginal man, has done a doctoral thesis called Aboriginal Pedagogies at the Cultural Interface. And it very helpfully articulates a model of Aboriginal pedagogy incorporating 8 aspects of learning that relate dynamically in the connection between Aboriginal and Western learning. And it's expressed in this graphic, which is not a linear graphic, if you notice. It's actually in the form of a kinship relationship. So those things are all interconnected and relate in particular ways, and you can't have learning without all of them. So he argues that one of the key aspects of Aboriginal learning is that it is embedded in story, place, and relationship. As I reflect on what I've learnt from Aboriginal people about being grounded, I hope I can share with you some of the stories of things that I've learnt. And there are 3 key areas I'm going to look at: land, kinship, and suffering. So I'll start with the story. One time I was taking a student with me as I was going down to Catherine Christian Convention, and it was just her in the car with me and my husband, and I was trying to chat with her and learn a bit about her culture, which was not really a culturally relevant thing to do in the first place. But we sort of saw all these trees that are everywhere up there. They're actually called turkey bushes for some reason. And I said, we're talking about these trees and what they're used for. And I said, what's the name for that tree in your language? She speaks Gunwingu. And she just looked at me really sadly and went, "That's too hard for you." And it was true. Much of Aboriginal language, culture and understanding was just too hard for me. Probably too hard for you too. One of my co-workers at Noongalinga spent 4.5 years as principal of Gower Christian School on Alco Island. And she explained that as she came across things she couldn't understand, she would sort of mentally put them in a dilly bag, which if you don't know is just an Aboriginal bag, put them in the dilly bag, and maybe at some other point in the future something would explain what was happening and she could take it out of the dilly bag. But when she left, the dilly bag was pretty full and not many things had come back out again. So this helps you to understand that what I'm reflecting on is a glimpse of Aboriginal culture. So the first thing I want to explore is the importance of land. For Aboriginal people, land has a significance that those of us from Western cultures can only begin to glimpse. However, as Christians, I don't think we should actually be surprised about this. Land was one of the keys for God's people, particularly in the Old Testament. In God's covenant with Abraham in Genesis 15, it says, God took him outside and said, "Look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." Then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." Abram believed the Lord and he credited it to him as righteousness, so many descendants. He also said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it." And we know that the promised land was an essential part of the people of Israel's understanding of who they were and of God's call to them and for their role in the world. For Indigenous peoples throughout the world, connection to land is one of the common threads. And it's not just about ownership or about anti-colonialism, it is about identity. Modern Australian society, though, is very different to that, isn't it? We're probably very different to the way cultures historically have viewed the land, this place we are at now. We are highly mobile, disconnected from the land. Most of us live in cities. Many of us no longer even live in houses with gardens, but might live in apartments. I had 5 years living in an apartment in Darwin. Didn't like that very much. Many of us are migrants or children of migrants, and our connection with this land may be very recent or one or two generations. How many people here have lived in the same location, general location, all their lives? Yay, good on you. I grew up in, this is my story, Brisbane, England and Brisbane, and then I lived in Melbourne, Sydney, Melbourne, Darwin, Melbourne. But even in Melbourne, I lived in completely different parts of Melbourne, including one lovely year here at Ridley College. The longest time I've lived anywhere in my life is 12 years in one place, and that was when I was growing up as a kid in Brisbane. And I don't think that I'm actually all that unusual. Our society is becoming more and more mobile, and our disconnection from land, and with that, local communities and family, is also growing as a result. And I was thinking about how this was reflected in popular culture. One of my husband's favourite pastimes is looking at realestate.com. And it's kind of infectious, and we fell into this trap of becoming very mobile in our thinking, and we were thinking about where we were going to live when we moved from Darwin, because we weren't going to stay there, it's too hot. We ended up buying a house in Queensland and we're now here in Melbourne, so that was a really bad idea. I try to ban him from realestate.com, but he sort of sneaks it in there sometimes. And it's reflected in our TV as well, you know, all those fixer-upper shows, you know, The Block and all those sorts of shows where you've got to, you don't just have a home anymore. You have a beautiful house that looks like something out of a home improvement show. And it's getting worse. Now we have tiny houses that are not even connected to the land at all. You just move them around wherever you want. This is reflecting that disconnection, I think, from the land. Whereas in spending time with Aboriginal people and visiting their home communities, I was struck by how important land was to them. Not their houses, land. Neville Naden, an Aboriginal elder, says, "Land for the majority of my people is everything about them, and they are everything about land. Land will survive without people, but our people need land to remind them of who they are. Land is not just a place we occupy, it is what gives us meaning and belonging." So this connection to land is not about ownership or productivity or even about somewhere to love, to live. Many would describe the land as their mother, or even that the land owns them, which is a completely alien way of thinking. It's a deeply spiritual relationship that they have with the land that affects everything about them. And there is a deep sense of God's presence in the land long before the gospel ever came with colonisers. And they've got to put that together now with the story of Jesus, and that's one of the challenges. One of the students' favourite songs at Noongalinga was called "Holy Spirit in This Land." Yeah. So intellectually, I think that we would accept that God reveals himself to us through the land. Romans 1 says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse." And in academia, we would call this general revelation. Yep. But as our society, and we're part of it, are becoming more and more disconnected from the land, that ability to actually see and hear God through his creation becomes muted. And we're using the term grounded in this conference. This is a key lesson for us, to connect with God through the ground, through creation. As we reflect on land and learning from Aboriginal people, the term songlines is important. This is actually a painting by one of the students of some songlines. Australia is covered in a network of songlines that tell the culture and story of Aboriginal people throughout the nation. These are ancient and many still exist today, although obviously many are missing because the land has been taken away. And they're connected to land forms and provide both a map to find your way, so there might be water holes and things like that, or mountains, but also a deeply spiritual understanding of the land in that place. Knowledge is embedded in place. So for Aboriginal Christian people, theologising is best done on their land, in their language. And it will often be expressed in story, in song, and in dance, not papers. So one of the ways we applied this at Noongalinga was we developed a song line around the campus that told the story of the big story of the Bible. So we started at the mango tree, which was the Garden of Eden. And then we were cast out of the Garden of Eden into the car park, which wasn't very nice, and closed the gate behind us. And then we walked all the way around. We had a 10-acre site at Noongalinga. So we could walk around, and each part of the campus was representing a part of God's story. We spent a bit of time lost in the wilderness behind one of the buildings. And one of our Indigenous assistant teachers would tell this story as we walked around the campus. And I was really interested to observe that at first she would tell the story in each place. But as we repeated it through the class, she would start prompting the students, and they would end up telling the story by the time we finished. So in a small way, this was an attempt for us to ground our learning in the physical context of where we were. And it was said to me not too long ago, and I was surprised at the time, but the Aboriginal elders actually regarded Noongalinga as a sacred site. Because that's what it's come for them, a place of learning open to all Aboriginal peoples, where they're encouraged to learn in their own languages, including English, and to share together. And that's become a sacred place for them. So I'd like to draw on some learnings more directly from Aboriginal people. You may have heard of Miriam Rose Ungama Bauman, and she has this theology called Dadiri. Now, I wouldn't claim to understand deeply what this means, but it can give us a real glimpse of that hearing from God. And rather than me explain it to you, we're going to look at her short promotional video, so she can share it with you in her own way. Hopefully we have sound. She's only breathing at the moment. Ah, that's it.
To know me is to breathe with me. To breathe with me is to listen deeply.
Writing about Dadiri, Miriam Rose says, "There are deep springs within each of us. Within this deep spring, which is the very Spirit of God, is a sound. The sound of deep calling to deep. The sound is the word of God, Jesus. We hear that, and I think we hear that sound as we deeply listen, away from the distractions connected to the land. Now, I'm going to be a bit tricky here. I'd like us all to consider joining in an exercise and take off your shoes and socks and stand up. Now, you might not have stockings on, so I understand this is a problem. You don't have to take your stockings off. To connect to the ground with our shoes on, doesn't it? I noticed one lady earlier took her shoes off anyway beforehand, so that was kind of good. You can sit down now. Admittedly, we are inside and we're on carpet, and it's probably a bit cold to send you all outside in the moment in your bare feet. But I encourage you to think about connecting to the ground without your shoes on. In Darwin, I only wore shoes when I had to. Even at the office, half the time we were always walking around without our shoes on. And there's something really different about connecting to the ground through your feet. It's interesting, we were talking about the body. My feet are my favourite part of my body. And if my feet are unhappy, I'm unhappy. So perhaps that's just me, but I think it's really an interesting exercise. It's very different to zooming past the country in a car, or even going for a run in running shoes, to actually just spend time connecting flesh to ground. You know, that's an interesting idea. Often when I would visit community, I would spend a lot of time just sitting with Aboriginal people. And we probably wouldn't talk all that much. We'd just sit on the ground together, and that got harder and harder as the arthritis set in. But it was really hard not to feel that I had to be doing something, making conversation, getting enrolment, moving on to the next group. I confess that I really just struggled just to sit and to be with someone. And one of my regrets in having moved away now is that I didn't take the opportunity more often just to sit with my Aboriginal sisters and listen to them. So how can we learn from this literally grounded view of the world and God? Well, obviously time is one of the big challenges, isn't it? We need to be willing to take the time to sit in a place and connect with it. I'm very fortunate that this year, for the first half of the year, I was only working 2 days a week. And this gave me more time. I found myself connecting with my new home in Jembrook in a new way by just walking around the place and enjoying it. Just being at home or being in the garden without having an agenda that I had to achieve something. And coming from a challenging and very busy role as a principal, this was both challenging but liberating, and I hope I don't lose that connectedness as my busyness increases with my new job. Well, the second area I want to think about is the area of kinship. We often use the word family in our society and church, but in my culture, family is a very small word, a nuclear family. You know, it might be my husband and my kids. But kinship helps us to understand wider interconnected relationships that we have. For Aboriginal people, everything is about relationship. Relationship with each other, relationship with the land, and relationship with God. And I've heard the distinction made between the Western view of family expressed as a family tree, and I'll leave you to guess whose family tree this next one is. Compared to an Indigenous view of kinship, which is much more like a bowl of spaghetti, where everything is touching everything. Western culture has a highly individualized understanding of the human person. However, many other cultures, including Aboriginal cultures, have a corporate worldview. And it's interesting that, as Paula said, this includes the biblical cultures. In Aboriginal cultures, to be truly human, you have to be in relationship, in kinship. It's a way of defining who you are as a person, how you should be related to, where you fit into the land and into the community. And so in order to be able to engage with non-Indigenous people, Indigenous people have developed this practice of adopting them into kinship. So I've been adopted by my yapa there, Rose, and that means I have a skin name. My name is Gumajan. And so when I meet Aboriginal people, particularly from that particular group, I'll say, my name is Gumajan, and they'll say, oh, who adopted you? I'll go, Rose Gawanga from Elko, and go, oh, you call me grandmother, or you call me mother, or you call me cousin. So we immediately have a connection, or all sorts of other names we don't have any kinship words for. So there's this immediate connection because of kinship, and it's more than just, you know, a recognition. It's, we're actually related. We are family. I remember a particular occasion when I was part of a panel at the Uniting Church Northern Synod, and they were all white fellas on the panel, and one of the Aboriginal elders got up and wanted to talk to us, and he went through each person on the panel, you know, and gave their skin name because he knew them, but he didn't know me. And when he got to me, he went, who are you? And I went, Gumajan. And he went, okay, I can talk to you then. Okay. So you can imagine what sort of problems that creates for people trying to consult with Aboriginal people about government policy. The Indigenous kinship structures are highly, systems are highly structured, and they have responsibilities and areas of respect built into them. These kinship structures are different across the different First Nations, but they all had them. They just might have different kind of patterns in them. And Aboriginal people can actually work out how they're related right across Australia by connecting the dots all the way across. Sometimes kinship relationships could be an issue to work around. At one stage, the chairperson of the board at Noongalingit was my Aboriginal son-in-law, which is an avoidance relationship. But there are always protocols and ways of working around that, so we managed. Once you are adopted into the kinship structure, you are family. And I find this a beautiful picture of the way God adopts us into his family through his son Jesus. Once part of the family, you have responsibilities and privileges. However, I think sometimes when we think about God's family, we impose our own cultural view of it. It's a small family. Maybe it's me, my father, and my big brother, Jesus. But we're actually part of a worldwide family of all ages, genders, ethnicities, political persuasions, denominations, and even theologies. Perhaps you've experienced this when you've met someone in a secular environment, you know, at work or in the shops, or when you're on holidays and you meet someone and you find out they're a Christian and you have this sense of connection with them. I think this is actually expressing that deep biblical truth that as God's children, we are family with each other. So how does that relate to being grounded? Well, for many individuals, being grounded often means looking within oneself or into an individual relationship with our God. But that is really fraught with peril. It's so dependent on yourself. Brian Rosner argues about authenticity. He says, the appeal to authenticity can just be an excuse for questionable behaviour. When we seek to create our own authenticity, even as we relate to God, the dangers of selfishness and pride and blindness are almost impossible to avoid, aren't they? It's very rare for a person to describe themselves as a really authentic, grounded person. It's something that somebody else observes in terms of your connectedness and your character. Aboriginal kinship reminds me of the importance of being grounded in the church, God's family. And many Christians today struggle with the church, and with good reason. We've been tainted by issues of abuse, domestic violence, as well as intellectualism, sexism, moralism, cultural imperialism. Yet this is our family. You know that saying, blood is thicker than water? That's meant to describe the idea that even when families are dysfunctional, there is some sort of a connection there. Well, how much more should that be relevant when we're talking about the blood of Christ is what actually binds us together? Aboriginal kinship relationships are not utopian either. There are all sorts of abuses in there, and a lot of that's because of interaction with dominant culture, but also just a result of fallen humanity. So when I was talking about the land, I identified that our society is a highly mobile one, and this has implications for kinship as well. As we move locations, we often disconnect from friends, neighbours, biological family, church. And perhaps I'm speaking from my own experience, but there are very few people who I interact with regularly who've known me for very long. I'm lucky to be part of a close nuclear family, my husband, my daughters, their husbands, my granddaughters, and we're all part of God's family together, which I'm very fortunate about. But that's not the experience of many people. And isolation and loneliness are common, even for Christians. So how can we become more grounded in God's family? Well, the first thing is pretty simple. Be intentional about it. It's not enough just to attend church, you know, fulfill all righteousness. I went to church this week. If church is family, then that entails responsibility and relationships. And I guess one of the key challenges for us is to intentionally build relationships. Sometimes I hear that churches are not friendly or that I don't fit in, and I've experienced both of those things. But we need to be prayerfully considering who we can develop relationships with and how we can be committed in that place. Staying a significant period of time is also a major factor. Relationship takes time, and I'm probably talking to myself here. When I was in Darwin, one of the distinctive features of church life was the high turnover of people. That mobility of people is really evident in Darwin. The statistics show that in 2017-18, the turnover of persons in Darwin was 16.4% of the population turned over. In Victoria, it's only 6.3%. So it's a highly mobile place. Most people leave towards the end of the year. I think they get sick of the build-up, which is the humid, and everybody goes a bit crazy and they leave. But for our church, at the end of each year, we would lose about a third of our members every year. And so this constant churn of people made it very hard to build relationships. And for me personally, there was also a sense that I was not going to stay forever. I was there to do a particular calling that God had placed on me, but I was not grounded there. And perhaps you can relate to that experience too. I think it's a particular challenge if you're involved in a ministry in a church, because it affects your relationships. And you know, that's a thing to build, that family, so that when you move away from that job, your family, your Christian family, doesn't disappear. So I'm very keen in this new stage of my life to be committed to staying in one location and one church for a long time. I'm getting old now though, so that might not be possible. But anyway. However, the reality for most of us is that our lives will be really mobile. How can we be grounded in God's family with that as a given? And I guess Paul is a great example. He was a travelling person. He moved, he visited churches, but he was an intentional correspondent, always coming back and writing letters, which we still have, although there was even more than that, connecting both with churches and with individuals. Once again, I think our Aboriginal brothers and sisters are a great example of this. They have embraced the mobile phone as a wonderful means of maintaining relationships. It could be a little bit of a challenging class at times. But I remember a lovely time when I took an Aboriginal friend. We were speaking at a conference and we were in Melbourne. And I took her up to the snow. And she'd never seen snow. We only stayed 5 minutes. That was enough. But for the rest of the day, she was on the phone and she was speaking Yolngu, so I couldn't understand what she was saying. But the word snow was in every conversation. No. And I'm now a grandmother, and people would say to me beforehand, aren't you looking forward to being a grandmother? And I go, no. I don't really like babies all that much. But I have 4 lovely granddaughters now, aged 4, 1, and twin girls who are 7 months old. You can have the family photo now. There we are. Oh, aren't they so cute? And it's really interesting that for Yolngu people, this is one of the most important relationships that there is. It's called the Māori-Gutara relationship. Māori is grandmother, Gutara is grandchild. And even connection between tribes are expressed as Māori-Gutara. And I find being a grandmother very grounding. Instead of, you know, running a college and doing all of these busy things, I'm changing nappies, delighting in first smiles, sharing the news regularly about what one of my grandchildren's up to, reading the same stories over and over again. One of the main reasons I left Darwin was so that my family could reconnect and be together. And I found it amazing how God has even worked through that. We're actually all part of the same church. And it is amazing to be an extended nuclear family, all part of the same church. And I'm part of a small church plant in Gembrook. And I said to my daughter the other day, this little church really feels like family. She said, Mum, 10 of us are related. And there's only 4 other people here. A bit bigger than that, but you know. And we recently had a visit from a group. Sorry, we scared the baby. We had a visit from a group involved in drug rehabilitation, and several of the recovering addicts shared their stories. And the director of the group gave us the challenge. He said, "You could grow by attracting other people who are Christians to your church, or people who are not happy with their churches to swap churches. Or you could continue to be different and reach out to the community with the gospel, to those people who desperately need to hear about Jesus. And your church will grow slowly and messily, but it will be something different and something authentic." And that really resonated with me, and I'm really excited about what God might do. And I think it might be a long process. So that leads me into my final topic, really, that being grounded in kinship really means sharing in one another's joys and sorrows. Land and kinship are sort of the traditional aspects of Indigenous cultures, and probably the ones that when I was invited to speak about that we would focus on. So at Noongalinga last year, I was facilitating a class on Indigenous expressions of faith, and we went through a process in the class to help students to develop contextual theology, and we focused on land and kinship as something that they could resonate with. They learned the process, and at the end of the week we said, all right, here's an opportunity for you to practice again with a topic of your choice. What would be the thing that you would want to reflect on? And nearly all the students wanted to reflect on the problem of pain. In my time at Noongalinga, every single intensive, we mourned with at least one student about the loss of a family member. We had not one intensive where there's not someone died. And it was usually ill health, suicide or accident. Very rarely the end of a long life. And many then had to wait months for funerals to occur, because there's so many funerals booked up that you couldn't have the funeral straight away. And so you have this extended period of grief. and many of the students themselves struggled with ill health or domestic violence. Yet in the midst of all this personal and generational trauma, most of them really clung on to God. So suffering is not a topic we enjoy discussing, and we find experiencing it even less pleasant, but it is very much a part of the Christian life, and it's modelled on Jesus. In the Incarnation, Jesus came as a weak and fragile human being, emptying himself of his glory, as Philippians 2 said. He came not to rule as a king in comfort and luxury, but to be homeless, itinerant, and eventually to be executed by colonising Roman powers at the request of his own people. And he says, "Follow me." Well, how does this relate to being grounded? It seems to me that being grounded relates to who we are when everything is stripped away. Who are we when our jobs, our homes, our families, our physical families, our health, our security, our reputation are stripped away? This is what Jesus experienced. He even experienced separation from God as he was on the cross, something I find very hard to understand. But for us, we have the promise that he will be with us even when everything else is stripped away. We will still be God's children, dearly loved. And we're in that process of becoming more like Jesus. I would imagine most people in this room have experienced some time of significant suffering in their lives. But suffering is not just an individual thing, it's a corporate thing as well. So we've just spent time reflecting on how kinship in God's family is part of being grounded. Well, kinship involves also being affected by the joys and sufferings of our family. Do we really feel the pain of dispossession, trauma, and powerlessness of our Aboriginal brothers and sisters? Do we feel the pain of those who fled to our country only to be made unwelcome? What about those whose biological families have fractured and disintegrated, or those who are just plain lonely? We don't have to look very far in our church families to find suffering. So how do we respond? Well, as women in academia, we might write a paper on the problem of pain. Might be helpful. But I think one of the challenges of being grounded is being truly connected with those who are suffering. Not to solve their problems, but to be with them in their suffering. As part of the Australian Church, and we've got this passage from Romans, which I won't read. As part of the Australian Church, God's family in this land, our individual sufferings will not disappear. And our corporate sufferings, I believe, will probably only increase until Jesus returns. We can see the thunderclouds of change appearing on the horizon as our society loses its Christian roots. And there is a temptation for us to tone down our distinctiveness, to seek to be politically correct, maybe bend a little bit here and there. But it seems to me that that's how we lose our groundedness. The whole image of being grounded is to be firmly rooted, connected, and centred, and that is centred on Jesus. He is the centre and foundation of our faith. To be grounded means to be connected to him. To be connected to him means to be connected to each other. To be connected to each other means to be connected to place. To be connected to place means to be connected to Jesus. It's an organic, incremental learning that involves the whole of our person, not just our mind. However, perhaps becoming more grounded in this land and in our kinship will help us with this. I'd like to finish with just a final story. How's my time going? Mandy is one of the assistant teachers at Noongalinga. She was the one who actually did that God story walk around the campus with me. And she's had enormous challenges in her life. But I've always been humbled by her joy in the Lord, despite her circumstances. She does the most beautiful worship dancing. I describe her as being grounded. She's not perfect. But I'd like to finish with her sharing about her reflections about connection to God. So we've got a video to show.
I see God in creation. His spirit is alive and living, and getting to know his word through Genesis make me think of how powerful and awesome God is, and how he came to the world and creating every living being, like the animals and the fish in the sea. I've learned that he's a creator, also he's a loving father who made everything and made us human. And he is caring and loving God. He speaks to me when I'm listening to my music, or when I'm drawing and reading my Bible, or just going out in the bush and seeing all the beauties in the bush, like all the colors, you know. I think of God in so alive and living, you know. And everything we see around us is like, it's like a reflection from Him, you know. And because of all our sins, like what the world gives, you know, trouble, pain, suffering, and a lot of our people are dying without God, you know. And when we see it in the Bible, God speaks to us that He's alive, you know. God loves all people, you know, and He wants people to come back to His light, and that's where He showed Jesus Christ when He died on the cross. And that's when we see God's grace, love, and forgiveness, you know, when He sent His only Son. And through Jesus, God is breathing His breath, you know, giving life to us. And we know that when Jesus died and went back to God, He sent His Holy Spirit to help us, you know, help and guide us while we are in this earth.
So Mandy reminds me that being grounded is not actually all that complicated. I'm just looking at Diane. So if anyone's got any